I'm Pamela Peterson, and this is number 6 of Women's Issues in Counseling. We're talking now about domestic violence. The National Coalition Against Domestic Violence lists 4 major myths about battered women. 1, abuse of women is not common. 2, abuse is limited to a particular socioeconomic and racial group. 3, battered women provoke violence. And 4, battering stems from an individual pathology rather than the patriarchal structures and practices of society. Most pastoral care providers know little about battered women, says Joanne Garma, and may not realize that each of these commonly held opinions is wrong. To begin with, she says, violence against women occurs across ethnic, socioeconomic, and religious lines. Some devoutly committed Christian women find that their acquired religious and community values keep them trapped in dangerously abusive marital relationships. Spiritual issues, she says, rooted in religious beliefs can be as punitive as the beatings. According to the National Crime Survey, 2.1 million women were victims of physical abuse by their partners at least once in a 12-month period. The FBI Uniform Crime Report states that 30% of all female homicide victims are killed by their husbands or boyfriends. The U.S. Surgeon General's report states that physical battering is the single largest cause of injury to women in the United States. It surpasses muggings, rapes, and automobile accidents combined. Studies on domestic violence reveal that alcohol and drugs play a major role in family altercations. Children who grew up in homes where there was violence tend to resort to violence in their own marriages. Widespread ownership of handguns adds to the problem. Lenore Walker, who has conducted extensive research on the battered woman, has developed the theory that the battered woman's response to her abuse comes out of a sense of helplessness or a sense that she has no control over the abuse, even though in reality she may have control. When listening to the battered woman's story, the pastoral care provider may feel overwhelmed by the woman's inability to act on behalf of herself or her children. The woman's passivity may seem exaggerated, unreal, or even repulsive. The questions often raised are, how can any able-bodied person allow herself to remain in such a dangerous situation? Why not just leave? Walker notes a 3-stage cycle of woman battering. The first stage is the tension-building stage. Here, the woman denies her own needs and feelings, such as anger, in an attempt to assuage the batterer's anger. What the woman is doing during this stage is accepting responsibility for the batterer's abusive behavior and simultaneously communicating to him that she accepts his abusive behavior toward her. What happens, however, is that the batterer's anger does escalate into stage 2, the acute battering incident, an uncontrollable discharge of the tensions that were built up during the first stage. The third stage is the kindness and contrite loving behavior stage, which is characterized by overwhelming calm and goodwill. The batterer knows that he has gone too far, becomes extremely loving and tender toward the battered woman, and asks for her forgiveness. His behavior is quite contrite. He truly believes that she has learned her lesson and that he will never beat her again. Each time he manages to convince himself and everyone concerned that he has battered his wife for the last time. He may even change some behavior to prove that he will change. The batterer also seems to be able to mobilize and utilize the influence of any or all family members to convince the battered woman to take him back. Garma notes that since most battered women adhere to traditional values about the permanency of love and marriage, they are easy prey for the guilt attendant on breaking up a home, even if it is a violent one. They have been taught that marriage is forever, and they believe it. The batterer's reasonableness finally convinces the woman that he will change. The woman wants to believe that the behavior of the batterer in stage 3 truly represents who the man is, without considering that he is also the person who brutally hit her. In her own mind, she convinces herself that with her support and with proper help, the batterer can change. However, as long as the battering couple remains together, generally the batterer will not seek the help he needs to change. New research by University of Washington psychologist Neil Jacobson sheds light on a particular subset of violent men. 1 in 5 who beat their wives appear to have no trouble curbing their anger. Rather, they have so much control that in the midst of battering their wives, their heart rate actually drops to a composed 35 or 40 beats a minute. They behave like athletes in the zone, says Jacobson. They have total focus, in this case, on dominating their wives. This group of batterers is no more likely to be helped by therapists than are serial killers, he concludes. Garma notes that the church has a long history of projecting external dictums on the woman, especially the battered woman. The worldview taught by the church, she says, subjugates the woman to the authority and control of the man. To question or to show initiative is interpreted as prideful and willful on the woman's part. The woman is metaphorically beaten into a dark abyss from which she sees no escape. The woman experiences shame in the same way that victims of sexual abuse experience shame. Whatever love she receives is earned and is usually withheld when her husband perceives her as not being good. She is never quite good enough. Her spirituality is experienced in terms of sin, judgment, and the call to perfection that is never attainable. The woman, therefore, remains bound by feelings of self-blame and guilt. Her suffering then is perceived as a means to attain penance and perfection. As Christ suffered for the sins of others, so should the battered woman suffer for her own sins and those of her abuser. She must believe that her suffering in some way will lead the batterer to change. Therefore, his redemption becomes her task as a Christian. She must remain faithful and humble if her man is to find salvation. The battered woman experiences forgiveness as something outside herself. She learns to live in a state of personal guilt for all the wrongs she has done. Yet she is quick to forgive her batterer, often with the encouragement of her pastor, family, and friends. Because of her shame, the battered woman believes that forgiveness for herself is beyond her reach. Forgiveness comes to people whose homes are peaceful, whose lives are orderly, and whose husbands and children are happy. Perhaps we also ought to address the question of battered husbands. Some studies show that 1 in every 11 victims of domestic violence is a man, battered by a woman. Priscilla Denham addresses the situation of the never married woman, the divorced woman, the widow, the single parent, and the homosexual. She notes that in the last 20 years, the role of women in our culture has changed profoundly. Women whose life processes have moved them, either by chance or choice, into non-traditional family patterns, encounter difficulty in finding churches and pastors who acknowledge, accept, and understand their lifestyles. Many factors have influenced this change. Perhaps the single most dramatic factor is the tremendous rise in the rate of divorce. With women's growing ability to control economic life through their own careers, women who have never married are choosing to bear or adopt children without a husband. At the same time that women became visible and valued in the business and professional world, church leaders have been discussing what role a woman should have within the church. Women are often still encouraged to fulfill the roles women filled in the 1950s. The problem is that even those women who are in traditional positions as wives with children are different from the same women who populated the church decades ago. Over half the married women in this country hold a job outside the home. For more than 10 years, the divorce rate has been half the marriage rate. Patterns of independent competence develop in a woman during and after a divorce. These insights do not go away, even though she might marry and become an invisible divorcee. Denham's criticism is that the church abandons these women at the point of their crises, evades responsibility, ignores the issues, oversimplifies the problem, and undermines the faith of those who must deal with painful life situations. Essentially, these are women without men. How do we understand and minister to them if our ideas about women are linked to them being some man's helper? Denham notes that dominant in the experience of modern-day women who have never married is the dynamic that they stand alone in their life activities. Contact with others, emotional or physical, must be chosen. It can never be taken for granted and may somehow be suspect. Fear is another dynamic. Many women say they must train themselves and learn how not to be afraid of being alone. Many women who have chosen not to marry are still faced with labels of old maid and the cultural given that married is better. The unmarried woman has no one to speak her concerns for her. She must speak on her own, often without support or encouragement. Kinship with others develops only with time, work, and some risk. A single woman may carry no weight in a congregation oriented toward family ministry. Sometimes other women may be anxious or distant, assuming the single woman is eager to catch a man, even a married one. Simply by her presence, the never married woman challenges the lifestyle choice of most other church members. Her difference may be interpreted as pathological or even sinful. Denham relates the situation of the never married woman to the gospel account of a woman with a flow of blood. Apparently a significant story to the early Christian community, recorded in all three synoptic gospels, this woman's story is one of only two instances in which a woman is cited as initiating a healing encounter with Jesus. 2,000 years ago, the rules prohibited a woman from speaking with a man publicly. Rabbinic law decreed a woman with any flow of blood should not be touched, lest that touch render the other unclean. Against all common sense, this bleeding woman risked contact with a noted religious leader. Jesus was on his way to the important task of healing the daughter of a powerful man in the community. This woman must have been compelled by a desperate desire for healing that would allow her back into her community of faith and into the normalcy of life that her malady had denied her. She seemed utterly alone. No one claimed kinship with her or stood by her. Because of the nature of her illness, she probably would have been unable to bear children, making her not valuable in the marriage marketplace of her time. She was an insignificant, alienated woman, invisible to everyone except Jesus. Luke tells us that when she saw that she was not hidden, she came forward, trembling. Jesus' response to her must have shocked all who heard it. He did not embarrass, condemn, or shame her for her action, which would have been considered inappropriate on so many levels. Instead, he called this woman daughter. The only time recorded in the Gospels where he calls anyone his son or daughter, here Jesus himself proclaims a kinship with this woman who was so alone. Then, in the presence of the people who knew her malady and knew that she had been unclean for 12 years because of it, he made a statement affirming her faith and its power. Addressing the situation of the divorced woman, Denham notes that for many women, divorce is not only a matter of separating from a spouse, but also separating from the church family. A woman's divorce is not only painful in and of itself, but also felt by many to be disobedient or sinful. Many women contemplating divorce are unable to find permission within the church structure to do what they intellectually know they need to do, Denham maintains. Many conclude that if the church is critical of their action, then God must be also. Many women feel their individual pain is not as significant to their church as is a doctrine regarding divorce. Women who have internalized so much condemnation regarding divorce may not have the courage to ask whether a church will accept them, but their silence does not mean they feel religiously content or secure. Many women assume that silence on the part of the church about a difficult issue probably implies condemnation. The woman caught in the act of adultery and taken to Jesus was not freed simply because she was not stoned. She had to hear an overt pastoral voice say, "Neither do I condemn you. Go in peace and sin no more," before she could really go on with her life. Denham notes that the story of Tamar in Genesis 38 is a reminder that widows are not always women who have most of their lives behind them. Widows of any age may be lonely and wish for appropriate sexual expression. Although this story is almost 3,000 years old, the religious, righteous indignation of the father-in-law who invokes Levitical law to have Tamar killed for her sexual behavior has a contemporary tinge, Denham maintains. He clearly sees her behavior as much worse than his own sexual behavior after the death of his spouse. Today, too, a double sexual standard continues. Widowhood itself is not criticized by the church, as it is not something a woman has chosen. The church does, however, often act as though a woman's sexuality died with her spouse, compounding the feelings of abandonment that come with death, with the message that the woman's own vitality must be sacrificed at the same time. Three widows of different ages in different towns expressed to Denham the frustration that after their husband's death, the church began to focus its relating around the grief issue alone, so that each felt her identity became that of the dead man's wife. Each of these women felt her life issues were more difficult for the church to respond to than her identity as a wife, even though her husband was no longer living. Denham notes that the only information more startling about the American family than the tremendous increase of divorces in the last 20 years are the facts regarding single-parent families. Single parents, who are mostly women, now head more than one out of every four families with children. They are single parents as a result of divorce, separation, widowhood, and never having married. Despite their large numbers, says Denham, single mothers do not feel part of a group that supports or enriches. Instead, what single mothers share most often is the feeling of being alone. Alone in the all-encompassing and sometimes overwhelming experience of responsibility for their children. Most mothers do not have support from the other parent of the child. Single mothers say that often, if the father is involved with the child, he is likely to use his power, for example, threatening to cut off child support or refusing to see the child at all, against the mother rather than for the child. Along with the mother's heavy responsibility is the reality that women have less power, both economic and cultural, than their male counterparts. Being a single parent also raises questions in others' minds regarding the mother's past. Were the mother and father married? Why a divorce? The visible child begs the question of the mother's invisible history. Single parenting is a physically exhausting job. All of the labor of a household must be carried out by one adult. Labor includes work outside the home, child care, house maintenance, the character building of the children, chauffeuring, recreational activities, maintaining family ties, and more. Single mothers need to hear a word of compassion that they do not and cannot do it all. Many in our society, says Denham, including single mothers, believe that single-parent families are a problem or bad for the children. Many mothers, however, have become single parents to protect their children from emotional, physical, or sexual abuse. A single-parent home may be less conflicted, rigid, or enmeshed than another home that looks normal to an outsider. A family's problemness should not be decided on the criterion of the number of parents in the home, Denham maintains. A single parent who is divorced from the father of the children must affirm the children while continuing her own life task of emotionally ending the marriage. This task of separating from a spouse while loving the child who is the embodiment of that union is always difficult. It is not made easier if the single mother must also battle guilt that she is inadequate simply by virtue of being a single parent. Denham uses the story of Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman to illustrate single parenting because, within the context of this exchange, a mother does come alone to plead for her child, risking the trespassing of not one but two different cultural barriers. She is determined to get help for her daughter. Jesus does not make her task any easier. Her first request is ignored. His disciples beg him to dismiss her. His apparent agreement occurs through his response that he is focused on the needs of Jews, not Gentiles. She comes and kneels before him to request again. Again he refuses, this time insultingly alluding to the Canaanites as dogs. Still she persists, using the metaphorical insult to press her point once more. Finally, Jesus responds, praising her faith and granting her daughter health. The dynamic most parallel to today's single mothers is in the woman's persistent efforts to take care of her child, says Denham. This woman is willing to endure insults, break the cultural rules, approach a foreigner, anything that might help. Obviously, this woman does not fall back on an alternate recourse. No one else will plead for her child. Perhaps, like most single mothers, she has become accustomed to doing alone whatever she needs to do to take care of the child she loves. This story is the only instance in the Gospels, other than the woman with the flow of blood, in which a woman initiates contact with Jesus to request healing. Note that Jesus was denigrating of her nationality, but showed no disrespect for her gender. Denham writes with great feeling for the plight of the lesbian. She relates the story of Susan, a seminary graduate and pastoral counselor who came from an abusive family and a conservative denomination where homosexuality was a foregone sin. Susan had been beaten routinely by her mother and father for 18 years and had been sexually abused by both until she was physically large enough to defend herself. She found, however, that the only way she could relate to men was through the safety of a structured relationship, such as student and teacher or chaplain and patient. To relate to a man as a close friend or a potential husband was terrifying for her. Women were less frightening, but even then, feeling comfortable with much closeness was difficult for Susan. In seminary, she had a sexual experience that did not immobilize her when she was able to be loved by another woman. Although Susan was not driven by strong sexual desires, she was starved for human closeness that did not hurt, an affection that was not self-serving. She could not simply stay away from relationships. She had already been deprived of intimacy and tenderness from others for years. The biblical Christian understands that no matter how much pain a person has suffered, God has made only one provision for sexual intimacy, and that is marriage between a man and a woman. A number of gay activists would have us believe that homosexuality is in the genes. Some recent studies postulate biologic factors as the primary basis for sexual orientation. However, there is no evidence at present to substantiate a biologic theory. Critical review shows the evidence favoring a biologic theory to be lacking. Many have concluded that homosexuality is not innate and have found no connection between sexual instinct and the choice of sexual object. Such object choice is learned, acquired behavior. There is no inevitable genetic inborn propensity towards the choice of a partner of either the same or opposite sex. The move toward biologizing homosexuality is not the result of a scientific consensus, but a political consensus. Masters and Johnson note that when dealing with problems of sexual preference, it is vital that all healthcare professionals bear in mind that the homosexual man or woman is basically a man or woman by genetic determination and is homosexually oriented by learned preference. Elizabeth Moberly maintains that a homosexual orientation does not depend on a genetic predisposition, hormonal imbalance, or abnormal learning process, but on difficulties in the parent-child relationship, especially in the earlier years of life. The underlying principle is that the homosexual has suffered from some deficit in the relationship with a parent of the same sex. Robert Lewis characterizes the homosexual community in terms of three groupings: the radical and pressing, the committed and coping, and the hidden and hurting. The radical and pressing, while numerically the smallest grouping, is the most vocal and is agenda-driven. It presses for social and philosophical acceptance through the propagation of myths with the assistance of pro-gay media. It presses for acceptance via education and legislation and in the Christian community by reinterpreting scripture. The committed and coping, a more moderate-sized grouping in the middle, is what Lewis characterizes as comfort-driven. For those in this grouping, homosexuality is the defining paradigm of their lives. They strive for love and acceptance as persons, although they may struggle and wrestle with their homosexuality. The largest and the quietest group, says Lewis, is the hidden and hurting. They don't like feeling gay. They are driven by the desire for anonymity. They are lonely and crave love and acceptance. They are willing to change. But, says Lewis, the church has abandoned this group. They are the lepers of modern times. Homosexuality is a behavior in Scripture, just like theft and murder. Homosexuality as a behavior is sinful, but it is not placed above other sins. Homosexuals, according to Scripture, can change. The cultural acceptance of homosexual behavior signals real danger, and the church's ministry to hurting homosexuals demonstrates real maturity.